Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Time now to catch up on the latest developments in the dizzying world of new media and social media with our Open House guru, Steve Krieger. So much to cover tonight. First, the top tweeters and Facebookers for that matter. Second, the perils of Facebook, especially when it comes to marriage. Third, is it possible to contain the screen time of youngsters? And fourth, the bizarre places where we're staying in contact through social media. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, Lee. Good to be back.
So much to cover tonight and converse about. First, let's go to Twitter. And you found an interesting project that tells us what's hot and where's hot and not on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. So the Queensland University of Technology have been involved in an interesting project mapping out how Australians use Twitter and what kind of connections they have and how those people are relating to each other. So they looked at 950,000 Australian Twitter accounts, and then they went down to the next level. They took the 120,000 most connected users and started to map out those connections and those interests, bring them together into some clusters to work out how these people are using this social network.
Okay, so let's see what they found first. What's hot then?
So the big areas of interest that people are talking about on Twitter are things like news and books and film, fashion and business. So some of those broad areas of interest are common topics of discussion.
What's not hot? What are the places in Australia that are not hot as well?
So a couple of things they observed. One is that Adelaide and Perth are particularly isolated clusters of conversations. Some sports groups, but interestingly for us, evangelical Christians, evangelical religious groups, were identified as being one of those groups that are particularly isolated on Twitter.
Okay.
They're just not connected to many other Twitter users.
Other groups not hot are lovers of beer and fans of Justin Bieber and the Jonas Brothers.
It's probably not the same people.
I think that's very true. So why do you think the evangelical or religious groups aren't hot then?
Yeah, I don't know whether this is a reflection on how we relate to the world at large, whether this is just an image of the isolation that Christians can have from other people more generally. There's a question as well about why people sign up to Twitter in the first place. So there's some people who use Twitter for general interest, to keep up with the news and to see what's happening in the world of business. But unlike Facebook, Twitter has a high level of users who are on there for particular niche interests. So I use Twitter to particularly for a lot of the Christian ministry that I'm involved in, communications and marketing, and so I'm connected into that niche group. And so I think there's something unique about Twitter that attracts people who are interested in very specific topics. So that could be one reason. I mean, the research has discovered as well that the people, the Christians, these evangelical groups that are using Twitter may not be connected to many other people within Australia on Twitter, but they have strong connections with other Christians and Christian groups overseas, particularly in the US. So it just highlights the types of connections that Twitter provides.
Yeah. So what are your hot tips on who you follow on Twitter, apart from some of those specific interests, or for that matter, Facebook?
Well, I mean, my interests are pretty specific. So I have found Twitter to be remarkably helpful for staying in touch with Christians from around the world. So I'm connected in with church planting groups and marketing groups and communication groups all the time, kind of just interacting with them and getting ideas for ministries that we could be running and improving in Australia. So a couple of guys, you know, so Tim Chalice, who's the biggest kind of Christian blogger in the world, has some great stuff to say on both Twitter and Facebook. There's ministries like Ligonier with R.C. Sproul that are particularly helpful. I think people like Rick Warren has some really interesting and insightful things to say that he's constantly sharing. Paul Tripp is another guy. He's currently tweeting about prayer with some great insights on prayer and its place in the Christian life. So these are a couple of guys that I find particularly useful to follow.
Okay. Let's deal with Facebook now. This is emerging as a more and more common dynamic, the growing role it's playing in wrecking marriages.
Yeah, this is a concern, I think. There was some research that was done in the US recently that found that more than one-third of divorce filings last year contained the word Facebook. So that was cited as a reason for the divorce. And in the same survey, 80% of US divorce attorneys say they've seen a rise in the number of cases that are involving social media. And Facebook being the largest network is certainly a big cause in this. They spoke with one divorce attorney who mentioned that of the 15 cases that he handles per year, where computer history or texts and emails are admitted as evidence, 60% of those cases exclusively involved Facebook. You know, I've seen similar examples and articles online as Facebook is being blamed or cited as the reason for marital breakdown.
So what are the ways in which it is undermining marriages then? How's that work out?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that are going on. One is that Facebook provides a level of intimacy, a level of safety that we haven't experienced before. So, you know, you can be anywhere in the world. You can be sitting on your phone or tucked away in your bedroom or wherever you have access to the internet, and you can be engaged in all kinds of conversations and relationships without anyone else really knowing what that's like. You're able to develop and progress those relationships without actually having to see that person face-to-face. So in the past, if you wanted to develop a relationship, apart from, say, talking to them on the phone or writing a letter, you'd have to go and meet up with them. And that was, if you know, this is an inappropriate relationship, a very big step to take. However, it's these small steps of sending a message, writing on someone's wall, can lead down a dangerous path, and Facebook just makes that kind of interaction far more easy. People are also commenting on how many relationships are being rekindled with old flames, yes. Past relationships, people we've had connections with before. So Facebook gives us connections with hundreds of people that we have known from the past, rather than just connections with random people that we've never met before. And so simply by opening up our opportunities to more people, the temptations are likely to increase as well.
And apparently this marital unfaithfulness happens far quicker than in other areas of life. Say in the office, for instance.
That's right. I think, again, because firstly, Facebook gives us an opportunity to share so much of our lives as we post updates and share photos. And so people are given an insight into other people that they wouldn't ordinarily have had, or that would take much longer in real life, if I can use those words, to develop. So you can see into people's lives, and then you're able to communicate with them so quickly and so easily. You don't have to go out to dinner or have a covert coffee. You can contact them constantly via message or even in real time, which just fast tracks the development of these relationships, or in the case of rekindled relationships, fast tracks the restoration of that communication.
It's probably another warning that our online world isn't quite as safe and certainly private as it seems.
I think that's right, and it's a reminder again. We need to be careful of the types of relationships that we pursue, and again, the openness that we have with our spouses about the accounts that we keep. So one of the common pieces of advice that I hear and would offer is that if you're married, you want your spouse to have access to all of your passwords and accounts. So you can say to them, "Here's my email account, and here's my Facebook address. Here's the passwords that I use. If you ever at any time want to go in and have a look at those things, you're welcome to. There's no privacy in marriage." So we keep those doors wide open, and that really reduces the opportunity for social media to be disrupting marriages.
There was a judge in the US that actually ordered a divorcing couple to hand over the passwords of their Facebook accounts to the other's lawyers. Good grief.
Yes. Yeah, that could be scary as the evidence is called for.
Yeah.
But much safer for us and much better for our relationships if we do that with each other much earlier on.
Long before. Okay, so next, screens, stealing childhood, so the claim goes.
Yeah, so again, kind of some researchers and some advocates are concerned about the amount of time that kids and young people are spending in front of the screen. And I guess as we observe this, it's pretty obvious. Everywhere kids go now, they're looking at screens, TV screens, computer screens. You know, even in the past, as you know, I remember going off on holidays with the family, you'd be driving for, 4 hours in the car, and all you got to do is to talk to each other and play I Spy. Now, we've got screens embedded in the back of the seat in front. And so everywhere, the concern is that because kids are so exposed to screens, they don't actually know how to live without them. And they feel that when they're not looking at a screen, they're bored and they don't know what to do. And so the amount of screen time is increasing rapidly. So we're looking, teenagers now, and they say, are looking at screens or listening to music for more than 7.5 hours a day. I'm in the US. I mean, in Australia, this has come up to 5 hours and is constantly rising. So, again, like with most aspects of technology, the researchers aren't really sure what impact this is going to have in the long term, but they're concerned because, again, we've got the first generation that have grown up with this extensive access, constant access to screens. They don't know what impact that's going to have in the longer term.
Yeah, part of the problem for parents is that all these dynamics are developing so rapidly before you know it, you turn around and your kids are consumed by these screens. What do you do?
Absolutely. And I think, parents, you sleep all the time, parents kind of giving their kid, the iPhone to play with or the iPad to play with in the same way that they didn't know what to do. They'd kind of entertain them with the television. Now they've got even more options. I think, one thing for us to do, I'm not a parent, but constantly aware of the temptation to spend more time in front of the screen is to be good at setting our own limits. So it's one thing to set limits for kids, but we need to be good at establishing our own boundaries for when we'll use technology, when we'll use screens, and when we'll have that time away.
So what are the recommendations for parents? What are they saying about the kind of ratio that's best screen time for kids?
Yeah, so they're recommending, depending on the age of the children, so for the very young children, they'll recommend a 1-to-5 ratio, so 1 hour of screen time for every 5 hours away from the screen, and then that increases. So you've got 1-to-1 for pre-teens, and then perhaps 5-to-1 for teens. Even that sounds, a little bit high from where I'm sitting, but... Yeah. Again, it's about working out the type of child that you have and how they like to spend time, but also where they might be tempted to escape. So constantly looking at how your child is using technology and whether that's impeding on their relationships and their jobs and how they communicate with the rest of the family.
And there are some kind of symptoms almost that parents really need to be on the lookout for that their kids might be demonstrating.
Yeah, that's right. So some symptoms like loss of sleep, attention deficit issues, loss of friends, issues with identity away from their online life. So there's some things that parents can be looking out for. But again, these can also be causes or symptoms of some other issues. So it's important to keep an eye on these things, but not necessarily attribute it to kind of spending too much time in front of the screen, as it could be some other things going on.
Yeah. So finally, we're finding out how desperate we are to stay connected on social media, some of the places from which we're tweeting.
The statistics now for Australia is that now 62% of internet users have a presence on a social network, with 36% of those people using that social network at least once a day. And so, interestingly, 38% of people still don't have any presence on social media, so it's still a sizable chunk. Mm. But within those people who are using social media, they say 6% are so obsessed that they have admitted to tweeting or posting while they've been on the toilet.
Tell me you haven't done that.
Well, I don't think I can, Lee.
Oh, really? Well, I can say I have never done that, but not for you, it seems.
No. So I have to admit I'm part of that 6%. Look, it's a great time to catch up on the news and to find out what's going on.
True confessions.
And at least I'm not alone, as these statistics say.
But, yeah, that's right.
There seems to be a growing interest in using social media, but again, a growing temptation for it to get out of control. We spoke a little while ago about the challenge that social media gives us to, we wake up in the morning and what's the first thing that people check? Well, it's Facebook. And what happens when